If you recall, at the end of the last class, the master had been in the region of Perea, that's the other side Jordan, and he'd had a visitor come to him, being sent from Martha and Mary. So he abandons his preaching campaign, crosses over Jordan, and comes to Bethany. From Bethany he was to go north towards Ephraim, and then he was going to go round Galilee and make his way eventually to Jerusalem, to his death and his resurrection. So John chapter 11 is probably one of the most familiar chapters in the Gospel of John for us. It's the raising of Lazarus from the dead, and I'm sure we all appreciate the narrative and the matters which are contained in this 11th chapter. Let's just remember one of two things. Remember the parable which we considered a couple of classes ago in Luke chapter 16, where the master gave the parable concerning the rich man and Lazarus. And this raising of Lazarus now in John chapter 11 is only a matter of days, if a week, after he gave this parable. And the point was, in verse 31, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. So it can't be coincidental that he calls the one in that parable Lazarus, and now he's going to raise Lazarus himself. And the reason for this is that the raising of Lazarus was now going to be the ultimate as far as the Sanhedrin were concerned. The master had said, though one rise from the dead, you will not believe. And it was quite amazing at the end of this 11th chapter of John, after the raising of Lazarus, that the Sanhedrin now issued his death warrant. There was no turning back now. They had come to the conclusion, because of the raising of Lazarus, that he had got to be put to death. So the paradox is that when he said, though one rise from the dead, you will not believe, that was so true that from this moment onwards, although they had tried on many occasions, they were now predetermined to put him to death. The other interesting thing about John chapter 11, it's the seventh sign, the seventh miracle in John's Gospel, and it's the last one that he will perform before his death. And so his raising of Lazarus was going to be an important one as far as John's Gospel is concerned. The eighth sign, the eighth miracle in John, is after his resurrection with the great draught of fishes which Peter caught. So this is going to be his last sign, the seventh sign before his crucifixion. So let's have a look at verse 1 of chapter 11, and I hope, God willing, we'll get through the chapter tonight, because, as I've said, it's quite well known to us. There was a certain man who was sick, named Lazarus. Don't forget, in the Hebrew, the name is Eliezer, whom God helps, or God is my help. That's the Old Testament equivalent of Lazarus, Eliezer. And he, we're told, was the brother of Martha and her sister Mary, and they lived in the town of Bethany. And to make sure that we understand that it's the same one as we've understood before, John makes the comment in verse 2, it was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Remember, we've seen that this home was also called the home of Simon the leper. And it is assumed, because of the inference more than we can actually prove it, that Martha was married to Simon the leper, but Simon had died. Martha, now a widow, had inherited the house, because we are told in another gospel it was her house in which they lived. So they had known sorrow and death before. But this time, it's their brother Lazarus who was sick. We're not told what his sickness was. They were so concerned that they sent someone to find the Lord Jesus. And we find that this messenger, in verse 3, comes unto the Lord, who, don't forget, was the other side Jordan. Therefore his sister sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. Now again, one can only infer, but I don't think they would have troubled the master unless they thought that Lazarus had a sickness unto death. I think they would have realized that without the master there was no hope for Lazarus. I don't think he just, you know, had a sickness which may or may not have been serious. I think they were well aware that this sickness was a sickness to death. But notice in verse 3 the message which they sent to the Lord. Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. Without question, Martha and Mary wanted that sickness healed. They wanted the master to cure Lazarus. But don't forget, they would have known of his previous miracles. He didn't have to come to them. He could have just said, Lazarus is now well, and by the power of the Spirit, he would have been made well. It didn't necessitate the master actually visiting the home. Neither, in verse 3, do the sisters actually request the Lord to heal them. They obviously desired it, but they didn't put that to the Lord. They simply said to the Lord, he whom thou lovest is sick. It was going to be in the Lord's hand as to whether Lazarus was going to be healed of this, of his sickness. And I wonder if that is an indication of the way we should pray. When circumstances are adverse, when there are problems, when we may know of someone we love who is sick, we generally would request in prayer that the Lord would heal him or her. We don't always put it the way verse 3 suggests. Behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. In other words, into thy hands we leave this situation, and the Lord will deal with it according to his wisdom. That seemed to be the implication of the two sisters. And in verse 4, when Jesus heard that he said, when Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. That was the message which the master sent back with this messenger. And I would suggest, by the time the messenger had reached the Lord knew he was dead. He'd left the home of Bethany with Lazarus desperately ill. By the time he had reached the Lord, I believe Lazarus would have been dead. And yet he sends the message back in verse 4, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified. And that was the message this messenger took back to Martha and Mary. And on reaching back the home of Bethany, Lazarus would have already been dead. And he comes back with a message. The Lord says, the sickness is not unto death. Now how would the sisters receive that? And the reason we know the message came back, look at verse 14. This was when the master had come to Bethany, he'd gone to the tomb, and he is speaking to Martha, and he said unto her in verse 40, said I not unto thee, that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God? Said I not unto thee, that thou shouldest see the glory of God? And that's the implication of verse 4. This sickness was for the glory of God. So the messenger relayed exactly what the master had said, that this was for the glory of God. And yet to them, Lazarus was dead. And the master had said, he's not going to die. Or does he? He says the sickness is not unto death. To them, Lazarus was dead. And the reason we suggest this is in verse 6, the master abodes 2 days still in the same place where he was. So after receiving the messenger, he stays 2 days. He then would have to cross the Jordan, make his journey up towards Jerusalem to the town of Bethlehem, which was only about 2 miles away from Jerusalem. But in verse 17, when he gets there, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. So I would suggest it was a day's journey for the messenger to get there, a day's journey for the master and his disciples to get there, and 2 days he'd stayed where he was. So by the time the messenger gets there, Lazarus was dead. Now think of that from the sisters' point of view and the trial of their faith. Let me just pick up a reference in the 1st of Peter chapter 4. First of Peter chapter 4 and verse 12. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. And there's no question Martha and Mary were experiencing suffering. And that's what the disciples and the followers of Christ, in filling up the sufferings of the Master, will also have to endure in their lifetime. On the way back to John 11, let's just drop into Philippians in chapter 1. Look what Paul says in Philippians 1 and verse 29. For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ not only to believe on him but also to suffer for his sake. And that's what the disciples, the followers of the Lord, will have to endure: the sufferings, the pain and the sorrow of this present life. And if you just go to chapter 3 of Philippians and verse 10, Paul's aim in life was that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death, if by any means I have attained to the resurrection of the dead. And so we share the sufferings of Christ. And Martha and Mary were obviously sorrowing greatly because of the death of their beloved Lazarus. And yet they'd had this message: he's not going to die, the sickness is not unto death. When they received that message, he was dead. Now, just in case we think that was very hard of the Master, look at John chapter 11 and verse 5. As if the Apostle John, in writing this, wanted to put in a verse now to emphasize the relationship of Jesus with Martha and Mary. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. There was no question it was a hard saying which the messenger brought back, something they would have not understood, something which would have puzzled them and possibly been very, very confusing unto them. But the Apostle John wants us to appreciate the Lord was doing it for a purpose. It wasn't because he didn't like them, it wasn't because he wasn't going to help them, it wasn't because he was trying to trick them or comfort them without any hope. There was a purpose in it, and that purpose was for the glory of God. And we've got to remember that. So in verse 6, when he heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. And again, John tells us why he did this. Look at verse 14. Jesus said unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. The messenger hadn't come back and told him. The Master knew, I believe, when the time the messenger had got there, that when he said verse 4, the Master already knew, through the power of the Spirit, that Lazarus was dead. He remains in the place 2 days, and he tells his disciples plainly, Lazarus is dead. And in verse 15, I am glad for your sake that I was not there, to the intent you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. So the point was that the master knew Lazarus was dead. This was going to be the glory of God, that the disciples might believe. Now, where does that phrase come to us again in John's Gospel? That these things were done that the disciples might believe. Let's just go over to John chapter 20. And this was the whole purpose which was being expressed here in this seventh sign, in the raising of Lazarus. Good evening. Right, John chapter 20, verse 30. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. These miracles, the eight miracles of John's Gospel, the eight signs, were written that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that we might have life through his name. And the fact that there was going to be no misunderstanding that Lazarus was dead, no question he might have just swooned, gone into a coma, or any of the other things which they might have accused him of, there was no question to anybody that Lazarus was dead. And he was going to be dead so that the disciples might believe when they saw the glory of God revealed in his resurrection. So that is the background as we know. But after 2 days, in verse 7, he saith to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples quite naturally say unto him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? By the phrase the Jews, you'll have a cross reference to John chapter 8, 59 and John chapter 10, verse 31. On both previous occasions, when he'd gone to Jerusalem, they had tried to stone him. So it was not something which the disciples hadn't got knowledge of. They knew that the Sanhedrin wanted to put him to death. And so there was a great risk factor in the master going to Jerusalem. But Jesus answers them in verse 9, are there not 12 hours in the day? Well, in the Jewish day there is. 12 hours of the day, 12 hours of the night, 6 till 6. If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. The light of this world in the natural context is the sun. The sun gives us the light, and because we've got light, we can walk around without any problems. But in verse 10, if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. So from a natural point of view, the master is making, you know, very good sense. From his own personal point of view, what he was saying to them, my hour is not yet come. All things are under the control of God. It is not yet the time when I am going to be taken and put to death. So there is no fear in going, in verse 8, towards Jerusalem. Look at the reaction of Thomas in verse 16. Thomas was the one who was urging his disciples, his fellow disciples, to go with him. And in verse 16, then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, the twin, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Now the master's hour was not yet come. He emphasized that so many times to them. And yet there was no doubt there was a reluctance on a part of the disciples to go with him, because they thought it was certain death. And Thomas, echoing the thoughts of the others, said, look, let's support him anyway. They're going to put him to death. We'll die with him. At least we can try and give him some moral support. At least we can try and help him. But there was no question they thought they were going to die. But the master didn't. He knew that the time was not yet when he would be taken. From a spiritual point of view, verse 9 and 10 is interesting. If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. The Master has already said in John chapter 9 that he is the light of the world. So if we walk in him, we don't stumble and fall to our death, ultimately. But if there is no light of truth, no light of the Lord Jesus in our life, then in verse 10, he will stumble because there is no light in him. So there is an obvious contrast between those in Christ, those who are in the light, and those who are in darkness and will stumble and fall to oblivion. And then in verse 11 he said, "These things said he. After that he saith unto them, Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may wake him out of his sleep. And the disciples, thinking naturally as always, said, Well, if he's asleep, Lord, that's the best thing for a sick person. He's going to get better if he's sleeping. He's going to have rest, and he'll be better when he wakes up. He shall do well if he's sleeping." In verse 13, Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking rest in sleep. And so, he says, Lazarus is dead. And then Thomas, why not Peter? Thomas says, let's go with him. Peter would normally be the spokesman. It is Thomas on this occasion who said, let's go with him. The next time we read of Thomas is when he said, I'm not going to believe. Unless I see him, I will not believe. And this was being done that they might believe. So all these things were tests of faith for the disciples. They haven't just been written for our sake. They were tests of faith for them. And it was shown to them that constantly they were failing. Now these are far greater people in faith than we'll ever be. And yet they were stumbling and falling because they failed to appreciate the light of the truth in these things which the Master was saying. Their faith was lacking. And what about ours? These things were written that we might believe that he is the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God. So in verse 17, that when Jesus came, he found that he had been in the grave 4 days already. And Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house. So the Master and his disciples makes his way across Jordan, up the hills, go towards Jerusalem. And don't forget, Bethany was on the east side. It was on the Mount of Olives side of Jerusalem. It was on the southwest slope of the Mount of Olives, but he'd had to come from the east, and he'd have to come up towards the Mount of Olives, and there was Bethany nestling in the hills. Then he went further up over the Mount of Olives and into Jerusalem. So where was the Master when Martha met him? He wasn't at Bethany. He was on his way to Bethany. That's what we're told in verse 20. As soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. Where did she meet him? We're not told, brothers and sisters, but we can infer. Can we go back to Matthew chapter 21? When he was going to ride on that eventful day into Jerusalem upon a colt, we find in verse 1 of chapter 21, that when they drew nigh unto Jerusalem, and were come to Bethpage unto the Mount of Olives, then sent Jesus 2 disciples. It could be that he was at Bethpage, because you've got Bethany and Bethpage very close together. And it may well be the Master had made his way, and Martha knew that he would be there. There is something else which may be more possible, and that the Master had actually gone to the Mount of Olives. Again, we don't know. All we know that the Master often went to the Mount of Olives for prayer. But wherever it was, Martha knew it, and in verse 20, she met with him. We're back in John chapter 11. And look at Martha's reaction. Martha said unto the Lord, If thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. Now one could say that was a tremendous statement of faith. I'm going to suggest it's a tremendous lack of faith. She did not need the Lord to be there for Lazarus not to have died. One word from the Lord, one thought from the Lord would have been sufficient. She assumed that the Lord had got to be physically there before any help was possible. And that's not so. The Lord is not here physically today, but he's still a pleasant help in time of trouble. And so he did not need the personal contact with the Lord for her brother to have been able to recover from his sickness. But she was convinced that if the Lord had been there, he wouldn't have died. Notice then what she says, which is a tremendous statement of faith, but I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee. What did she want more than anything else at that time? Lazarus to be risen again. The Master says, in response to her faith, thy brother shall rise again. But look at her reaction then. I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. So she had assumed, even though Jesus had raised the widow's son at Nain, that had been dead, risen from the, so there had been people risen from the dead, we think of Jairus' daughter, and she knew that the Lord was able to raise people from the dead, but she had thought now that it was too late for Lazarus, and she had put it to the ultimate at the resurrection at the last day. Why would she do that? If she had desired for Lazarus to rise, if she had said in verse 22, whatsoever will ask, God will give it thee, she was not doubting the power or the ability of the Lord to do whatever his will was. And yet when he says, yeah, he'll live, she automatically thinks of the last day. Why wouldn't she think the Master would go and raise him? Keep that in your mind, as you'll see it as we progress. But Martha's statement in verse 24 shows a hope of the future. She obviously believed in the Master. And in 25, Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? Now the words are so familiar to us, and they're often recited, are they not, at a funeral, that we naturally assume that the Master is speaking about what verse 24 has said, that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last time. The Master says, I am the resurrection and the life. So we naturally put verses 25 and 26 to what the Master will do when he returns to the earth. Now there's no doubt that is true. I don't think that's what the Master is saying here. What he was saying to Martha now, not just in the future, Martha, you're absolutely right about the resurrection at the last day, but now I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. Believest thou this? Do you believe, Martha? And whosoever, Martha, liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Do you believe that, Martha? And what does Martha say? Verse 27. Yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Messiah, the Son of God, which should come into the world. Think what we've seen from John chapter 20. These signs were written that we might believe that he is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and where we might have life through his name. So he was putting Martha's faith to the test. Lazarus was going to be raised again because of the faith of those two who believed now that he would rise from the dead. Or did they? The Master was saying in verse 25, "Now, Martha, though he were dead, yet shall he live." And Martha, in awe of the statement what the Lord had made, says, "I believe that you can do anything, Lord. Thou art the Messiah which should come into the world." And then in verse 28, when she had so said, she went away and called Mary her sister secretly, saying, "The Master is come and calleth for thee." Why hadn't Mary gone? Don't forget, it was Martha who is renowned for the keeper of the home. It was Martha who was there, you know, always sort of slaving away in the kitchen, doing the food and that, and it was Mary who was sitting at the feet of the Master, listening to him, listening to the words which came from him. Why had Martha gone to meet the Lord and not Mary? Let's read on. "The Master is come," she said to her sister, "and calleth for thee." And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into the town, but was in that place where Martha met him. It would be nice to know where that place was. There was obviously something special about that place, but for some reason the Apostle John doesn't tell us. But Martha goes to Mary. Mary is told the Master wants you, and Mary goes. Then we're told in verse 31, "The Jews then, which were with her in the house, and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out, followed her, saying, She goeth unto the grave to weep there." Didn't Martha need to be comforted? Why should the people be with Mary? Why should Mary have such a heavy heart? Why didn't Martha seem to have that same concern, that same sorrowing as Martha? Verse 31 tells us they comforted Mary. In verse 32, "When Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." That's virtually what verse 21 says. So what Martha had said, Mary had said. The difference was in their position. We're not told anything about Martha. We are told that Mary fell at his feet. She worshipped him, she prostrated herself before him, and she was crying. Verse 33. Jesus saw her weeping. No mention of that of Martha. Mary seemed to be the most sensitive, the one where the death of Lazarus had affected more. Martha seemed to be able to cope with it, more able to be outspoken, able to go and meet the Master and say, you know, why hasn't it happened, Lord? Why weren't you here to save our brother from dying? Mary seemed to be very cut up about the whole thing. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping, which came with her, he groaned in his spirit and was troubled, and said, Where have you laid him? They said unto him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. Now, much has been made of verse 35. Many have tried to suggest that it was because of their lack of faith, of the general attitude of everyone who was there, that he wept sorrowing because they hadn't got the faith to believe that he would be raised from the dead. There may be an implication of that, brothers and sisters, but I think the majority of the one is in Hebrews chapter 5 and elsewhere. Look at Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 7. who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that he was that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared, though he were a son, yet learnt he obedience by the things which he suffered. He bore our infirmities, our sicknesses were laid upon him, says Isaiah 53. And the Master was an emotional person, and he felt human nature as much as we feel human nature. In the days of his flesh, and it was necessary, he came in the form of human flesh, and he saw the sorrowing because of death. And there is a time to weep. And when we lose a loved one, we know as far as this life is concerned, that's the end. Although they will be raised again in the hope of the resurrection, nevertheless, the Master felt how short this life was, how prone the nature was to sin and death, and the sorrowing and the grief which it all caused. And I believe that in verse 35 of John 11, the Master shared our infirmities. He understood our sorrowings and our sighing, and it's no good saying, as some try to say, oh, you shouldn't worry about if somebody is dead, you know, we know they'll rise again. It's quite not only just a natural thing, but it's also which is taught throughout the scriptures, that we are going to sorrow for those who we have lost, our loved ones. We're not going to weep in the sense that we don't think we'll ever see them again, but it will never be the same, because in the resurrection there will be neither marrying nor giving in marriage. And so the Master was grieving because of this human nature which we bear, this sin riddled body. And I believe he was aware of the concern and the grief and the sorrow of those who were around him at this day. Then said the Jews, behold how he loved him. And in verse 37, some of them said, could not this man, which have opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died? Now the Master, therefore again groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. Yes, the whole point of this was that they might believe on him. And they were doubting whether he'd got the ability to raise him from the dead. And I believe in verse 38, the Master now groans within himself, saddened, disheartened because of their lack of belief and faith. And Jesus said, take you away the stone. And look who it is who responds. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said unto him, don't forget, Lord, remember now, he stinketh. He's been dead 4 days. She obviously thought it was a waste of time, because look at the Master's response. Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldst believe, thou should see the glory of God? Then she took away the stone. Sorry, then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. When did he pray? He must have prayed in verse 3. Because he knew then it was God's will that Lazarus was to rise again. I thank thee that thou hast heard me. But he goes on to say, and I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. And that's the whole point, being repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated. And if there's only one thing which we remember from John chapter 11, then it'll be the greatest thing that we'll ever remember, that these things were that we might believe, verse 27, that thou art the Christ, the Son of God. Though one rose from the dead, they would not believe. That's what the Master says. And one rose from the dead and they would not believe, and the Master is risen from the dead, and we still don't always want to believe. And that was the whole point of this. No exposition of Old Testament scriptures. It was a simple, straightforward belief. All that the Master wanted us to do was to believe that these things happened and they were made possible because he was the Messiah, the Son of God. That's what he's emphasizing. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." He didn't have to say anything. Lazarus could have come forth. But he's remembering and appreciating who he's dealing with. He's dealing with human beings who are lacking in faith, lacking in understanding. Think of John chapter 5. He'd already given this to them concerning the last days. Verse 25 of John chapter 5. "Verily I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." The dead can't hear. The dead know not anything. We know that from the Old Testament scriptures. So it's only those who will be raised from the dead that will hear the voice of the Son of God. But it's said in the connection, like we're raising somebody from sleep. You know, when we're shaking them and we're saying, "Come on, wake up, wake up, and wake up." And they eventually come round and they wake up. That's what Jesus wants us to understand. That's what he'll do to the dead. That they will wake up, as it were, from the sleep. Because as far as the believers is concerned, that's all it is. And so he was shouting to Lazarus as if he was waking somebody out of sleep. Look what he said in verse 11 of John chapter 11. "Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may wake him out of sleep. And the Lord shall descend with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and the dead in Christ shall rise first." That's what Paul in Thessalonians is to send us. And so for our sakes and for their sakes, brothers and sisters, not for his, these things were done that we might believe and they might believe. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Then said Jesus unto him, "Loose him and let him go." And I've heard a Bible class address on verse 44, when they were trying to puzzle out how could somebody who was bound hand and foot come out of the tomb, because it would have been impossible to walk. We've just seen the Master raise somebody from the dead. If he did handstands coming out of the tomb, it would not have been impossible. Why do we lack belief in what the Lord Jesus was able to do? What he was bound up with mortality. Lazarus was going to die again. But there was one who was going to have the grave clothes and the napkin in a separate place when the tomb was empty. Loose him and let him go. And that's what the Master wants to do with us. He wants to loose our mortality. He wants us to let go and be free from the shackles of sin and death, that we may go unto him and live. And that's the whole purpose of what he's doing this, is for our sakes. And now, look, we've got the reaction of those who will and those who will not believe. Verse 45. "Then many of the Jews which came to Mary," verse 31, "and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done." Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." We either go his way or our own way. And those who believed on his way. Verse 45, "Those who didn't went their own way." Now, how was it possible, when you see somebody rise from the dead, that you would not believe? How is it possible to see a miracle like that and not believe? And yet they were not only not believing, look what happens next. "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council." This was the full council of the Sanhedrin. 71 of them, the 70 elders, and the one leader, the chief priest, the high priest. So there were 71 in the Sanhedrin at that time. And so they gathered 71 men together because obviously women were excluded now in the Jews. What do we, for this man doeth many miracles. If we let him alone, all men would believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. And it's quite interesting, brothers and sisters. You've probably understood verse 48, as I was taught when I first came into the truth and in subsequent classes. What they were concerned about in verse 48 is that the Romans would come and take away both our place, which is the temple, and our nation. Both our place, our temple, and our nation. It wasn't theirs, it was God's, we know that. But why should the Romans do that? If all people believed on him, and that's what they're saying in verse 48, why would the Romans want to come and take away their place and their nation? Because the Romans also would want to make him their king. That was their concern. And if you think I'm exaggerating that, just go over the page. And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest, remember what Caiaphas was, apart from a callous old man, what Caiaphas was a Sadducee. And a Sadducee don't believe in the resurrection. So he must have thought he saw a ghost when he saw Lazarus rise from the dead, because they don't believe in resurrection. But he wouldn't have believed in a ghost, because they don't believe in spirit either. So what did a Sadducee make of Lazarus? Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, "You know nothing at all." He's talking to the full council of the Sanhedrin. You've got Gamaliel there, you've got Nicodemus there, you've got some of the learned men of the Jews, and he said, "You don't know anything at all, you're stupid. Nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not." Now we know, because of what goes on afterwards, that Almighty God used those words to give a prophecy. But there's no way Caiaphas meant it as a prophecy. Caiaphas meant it literally. Weigh up the odds. What's better? The whole nation to believe on that man, who we know to be an imposter, or for one man to die? Which is best? For the nation to perish, or one man to perish? He wasn't talking about the saving of the nation. He was talking about the perishing of the nation. But it's turned around in verse 51. "And this he spake not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation." Now the point is taken up by the Spirit. "And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad." And that would include any of the Romans also who were prepared to believe on him. If we let him alone, all will believe on him. So what were they concerned about? That Gentiles would believe on him. And that's what the Spirit takes up in the thought of Caiaphas. Not for that nation only, but for Gentiles, for Romans, for anybody. It just proves that this man's an imposter. And in verse 53, "Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death." What had convinced the Sanhedrin to issue the death penalty? They, the council, decided they would put him to death. On what grounds? On what grounds could they put him to death? That he did miracles? That he spoke with authority? On what grounds could they put him to death? Because of this death penalty, in verse 54, Jesus walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence into a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And he never was to walk among the Jews until he rode into Jerusalem upon the colt 4 days before his death. So there was no question, there was now a united front to put him to death from the council of the Sanhedrin. What had caused Caiaphas to persuade them that this was so? He was not in the majority. The Pharisees held the majority in the council. So by a democratic vote, the Pharisees believing in a resurrection, it wasn't on that count. If it had been the other way around and the Sadducees had had the majority, then they could have gained the decision. But that wasn't the case. The Pharisees had got more in the council than the Sadducees, albeit a Sadducee was a high priest at that time. So how did he convince them? He'd got to convince them from the Old Testament scriptures. He'd got to prove somehow that this man was not who he claimed to be. But how did he do it? Can I put a suggestion to you, brothers and sisters? Can we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 13? This was written in the law. Verse 1. If there rise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, think of what John is talking about with his miracles, the signs, and the sign and the wonder come to pass whereof he spake unto this, saying, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them, thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or the dreamer of the dreams, for the Lord your God proveth you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all thy soul. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and cleave unto him. And that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has spoken to you to turn you away from the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt, redeemed you out of the house of bondage, and thrust thee out of the way which the Lord thy God commanded thee to walk. So thou shalt put evil away from the midst of thee. And I think Caiaphas picked that one up. And he says, look, this is exactly what the law has warned us of. A man will be able to do miracles, signs, wonders. He will say that he is a prophet. But all he's trying to do is turn us away from our God. How would he be able to sustain that? He breaks the Sabbath. He claims that he is a God himself. He tries to make himself equal with God. And so on that basis, this man deserves to die. All he's trying to do is turn us away from our God, from our law, from keeping the commandments. And that would have been a potent argument. And the council would have been undecided, or would they have been convinced? You put a resolution to a business meeting, and if people are not sure, they'll vote on the side of caution. And the caution is, you might be right, we'll go along with that. Because if it's of God, what we're trying to do anyway will come to naught. So let's take him, let's see if he's God, we'll deliver him, because if he is the Messiah, then we know he will be delivered from us. And I think on the basis of reason, they took hold of the Master, or were trying to take hold of the Master, and put him to death on the basis of the law of Deuteronomy 13 and of the other things which he had said and done, and also that if he was truly Messiah, then it would become abundantly plain. If not, and they put him to death, then it would prove that he was an impostor. And so the council was swayed, and they voted to put him to death. When we come back to John chapter 11, brothers and sisters, remember verse 54. The master then goes into a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. Let's keep your finger there and come over to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17. Verse 11. And it came to pass as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. And that's where we shall take it up next time, God willing. We're going to go back from John 11:54 to Luke chapter 17, verse 11. Because he goes to Ephraim and he goes through Samaria and Galilee to make his way back to Jerusalem, to pick up verse 55 of John chapter 11. And the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand. And that was going to be 6 days before Passover, when the Master eventually returns to, where? Verse 1 of chapter 12, Bethany. So he's going to make now his last preaching tour, as he goes through from Ephraim to Samaria to Galilee, and then makes his way back towards Jerusalem, and he comes back to the place where Lazarus was raised from the dead. And look at verse 1 of chapter 12. Then 6 days before the Passover came to Bethany, where Lazarus, which had been dead, whom he had been raised from the dead. And there they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table. Verse 9, much of the Jews therefore knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death, because that by reason of him many of the Jews went away and believed on Jesus. Now the Master had been gone a few weeks, maybe 3 months at the most, after he'd raised Lazarus from the dead. Why had the people in verse 9 seen him before? He was in Bethany. Lazarus lived in Bethany with Martha and Mary, and yet the Jews came specially to see Lazarus. The implication is he'd not been there for 3 months. Jesus had taken him with him as he left Bethany to go to Ephraim, Samaria, and round. And Lazarus had accompanied Jesus. Why? So that wherever village and town and city they would go, this man was risen from the dead, that you might believe. They will not believe though one rise from the dead. And it was not going to be just one little town of Bethany who was going to witness this. All throughout Judea and Galilee, the Jews were to see Lazarus. And the Master took him perhaps for his own protection, but also as a sign. And the sign was that this man has risen from the dead, that you might believe. And that is what John is telling us. That the Lazarus was this complete sign, because it was the seventh sign of John's gospel. This was the complete sign. And if this didn't convince them that Jesus was the Messiah, then nothing would, and nothing will us also. And so when we think of Lazarus, and when we think now of the Master going on these few last weeks, think that Lazarus is with him every time, that they might believe.